launch his new venture. The first massive task that presented itself was to analyze the basic problems of the organization and assault them head-on. The notorious investigation by the state legislature had revealed ubiquitous corruption from top to bottom. The police force was found to be utterly demoralized. It had been revealed that Tammany required new police recruits to pay a fee for their appointments, with the understanding that, as they rose in the ranks, they would participate in the blackmail fund Tammany accrued by their multifarious extortion schemes. For a monthly fee, gambling houses and brothels were guaranteed protection from raids. Grocery stores could display their wares on the sidewalk, and compliant saloons could remain open on Sundays. With each higher rank a policeman or politician attained, his percentage of the blackmail fund grew. Roosevelt's diagnosis of the situation led to the formation of a three-pronged strategy. He had to purge leaders at the top, change the culture in which the individual policeman worked, and deal a fatal blow to the widespread system of graft and bribery that enveloped the police, the politicians, and the managers of thousands of small businesses. Within 3 weeks of his swearing-in, Roosevelt forced the resignations of the powerful superintendent of police, Tom Burns, and his chief inspector, Alec Clubber Williams. Questioned under oath during the hearings conducted by the state legislature, neither man could adequately account for how they had accumulated hundreds of thousands of dollars in their bank accounts. The sudden firings generated headlines in every city paper, signaling that the new police board would spare no man in its drive to weed out corruption. In the future, merit alone would guide appointments of recruits and determine every level of promotion. Roosevelt's assertive action provoked anxiety on the part of the Republican bosses. They feared he was moving too far, too fast, and creating uproar wherever he went. So long as Roosevelt could count on the full-throated support of the public, he would stick to his guns. Despite the changes he had made in the top leadership, Roosevelt recognized that lasting reform would be determined by the behavior of the patrolman on the beat. Accordingly, he initiated the second prong of his strategy, to patrol the patrolman. He resolved to learn firsthand the nature of the patrolman's work and to lay down the values of a new culture for the entire force. Following the advice of Reese, he made a series of unannounced midnight rambles. Disguising his identity with an oversized coat and a floppy hat drawn down over his forehead, he roamed the streets of a dozen or more patrol areas between midnight and sunrise to determine whether the policemen assigned to those zones were carrying out their duties. With Reese by his side, to help him navigate parts of the city he barely knew existed, Roosevelt found policemen relaxing in bars, eating at all-night restaurants, entertaining women on street corners. In each case, Roosevelt summoned the officer to appear at headquarters the following morning for disciplinary action. In one instance, he found a patrolman eating oysters at a Third Avenue bar. Without revealing his identity, he inquired why the officer was not on the street at his post, where he belonged. "What is that to you? And who are you, anyway?" the officer asked. "I am Police Commissioner Roosevelt," came the reply. "Sure you are," the policeman mocked. "You're Grover Cleveland and Mayor Strong, all in a bunch."
"Shut up, Bill," the bartender said. "It is his nibs, sure. Don't you see his teeth and glasses?"
Stories of Roosevelt's unprecedented midnight rambles captivated reporters and the public alike. After his initial foray, seasoned reporters and writers often accompanied him, including Lincoln Steffens, Hamlin Garland, Stephen Crane, and Richard Harding Davis. Within short order, these nocturnal forays produced headlines across the country. "Sly policeman caught by Slyer Roosevelt," one headline read. "Roosevelt on patrol. He makes the night hideous for sleepy policemen," blared another. Cartoonists had a field day, Cartoons of policemen crouching in fear at the sight of an enormous set of teeth, metal-rimmed spectacles, and a mustache entertained the country and ushered Roosevelt into new national prominence. The Chicago Times-Herald dubbed him the most interesting man in America. But as one reformer noted, however amusing to the public, Roosevelt's purposes were entirely serious. The prospect that the commissioner might suddenly appear in the dark of night made individual patrolmen more accountable for their actions. To reformers, these reconnaissance missions were emblematic of the beginning of a new epoch. Even as Roosevelt disciplined individual policemen who were shirking their duties, he insisted that the majority of the police force were naturally first-rate men, caught in a bad system that had to be changed to reward merit, not wrongdoing. When he came upon an officer on proper patrol, he offered encouragement and thanks. If he found a designated area where every patrolman was on his scheduled watch, he sought out the officer in charge. "You are to be congratulated, sir," he told the sergeant with effusive goodwill. "This precinct is well patrolled." Maintaining that it was as important to recognize good behavior as to punish bad conduct, he established a system to award certificates and medals to officers who exhibited courage and daring. Men who risked their lives to catch criminals, struggled with runaway horses, saved children from drowning, and performed countless other heroic deeds in the course of their everyday duties. Recognition ceremonies, promotions based solely on merit, professional training, a new school of pistol practice, and the formation of a popular bicycle squad, such a combination of programs provided incentives to the men with the nightsticks. An innovative bureaucrat, Roosevelt introduced a range of technological improvements to the police department, including a rogues gallery of photographs, the use of fingerprinting, and an expansion of telephone communications. The morale of the police force began the slow process of healing and restoration. At the same time, Roosevelt recognized the importance of building a police force that represented the diversity of the city. By the end of his tenure, all the dominant ethnic strains were included: Irish Americans, German Americans, African Americans, Jews, Scandinavians, Italians, Slavs, and many other nationalities. Seeking to weld them into one body, he acted swiftly when signs of prejudice or discrimination became visible. "When one man attacked another because of his breed or birthplace, I got rid of him in summary fashion," Roosevelt claimed. As police commissioner, Roosevelt proudly noted, "My whole work brings me into contact with every class of people in New York as no other work possibly could." His position on the police board included membership on the Board of Health, authorizing him to scrutinize sanitary conditions in the slums in a more systematic and comprehensive way than afforded by the single eye-opening visit under the auspices of Samuel Gompers he had made a decade earlier to the cigar tenements. Together with Reese, he conducted inspections of overcrowded, unsanitary tenements with crumbling staircases, peeling walls, insufficient air, and unlit hallways. "One might hear of overcrowding in tenements for years," Reese later remarked, "and not grasp the subject as he could by a single midnight inspection." "After midnight, the slum is caught off its guard," Reese remarked. "The veneering is off, and you see the true grain of the thing, especially on sweltering summer nights." The reports Roosevelt made to the Board of Health forced owners to make improvements, to light dark hallways and fix unsafe stairways. In several cases, the worst tenements were raised. No action Roosevelt took during these months required more strength and resolution, and in the end, took a greater personal and political toll than the third prong of his headlong assault: his mission to sever the taproot of corruption, the Sunday closing law. Over the previous decade, the law had been warped into a colossal sluiceway of political and police graft. Owners and managers of the more than 10,000 saloons operating in the city understood that so long as they continued making a monthly dole to police and politicians, they were free to remain open on the most profitable day of the week. Those who refused payment were summarily shut down and arrested for violating the law. The result, Roosevelt argued, was that the officers of the law, the politicians, and the saloon keepers became inextricably tangled in a network of crime. By enforcing the law fairly and squarely against all establishments, instead of imposing it against some and not others, he hoped to eliminate the central source of the city's corruption. Personally, Roosevelt did not agree with the Sunday closing law, which the state legislature had passed as a concession to rural constituents. For the working class, on the job 6 days a week, the local saloon was a place to relax with friends on their day off, to drink beer, play cards, shoot pool, and talk politics. But the law was on the books, and as police commissioner, Roosevelt felt he had no honorable alternative save to enforce it. He had never been engaged in a more savage fight, Roosevelt told Cabot Lodge. The months of warfare had begun to show results, however. Surveying the battlefield with his comrade-in-arms Jacob Riis, driving and walking around for 9 hours to see for ourselves exactly how the law was enforced, I had no idea how complete our success was. Not 4% of the saloons were open, and these were doing business with the greatest secrecy and to a most limited extent. Though he had fully expected the furious rage of the saloon keepers and their political allies, he was ill-prepared for the venomousness of the messages that flooded his office from members of the working class. You are the biggest fool that ever lived. You are the deadest duck that ever died in a political pond. What an ass you have made of yourself. A box sent to his office containing dynamite detonated before reaching its destination. A less resolute man would have backed down, observed Jacob Riis, but he went right on doing the duty he was sworn to do. Refusing to take the howl of criticism personally, Roosevelt astonished his critics when he accepted an invitation to attend what turned out to be a massive parade protesting the new enforcement policy of the police czar. Escorted to the reviewing stand on Lexington Avenue, he stood for 2 hours, smiling and waving as decorated floats and more than 30,000 marchers paraded by carrying scornful banners and placards. Citing one large banner inscribed with the words, "Roosevelt's Razzle Dazzle Reform Racket," he asked the men carrying it if he could keep it as a souvenir. His good-natured embrace of criticism captured the imagination of the crowd. "Bully for Teddy!" marchers shouted. "Teddy, you're a man!" The Chicago Evening Journal summed up the day's event, cheered by those who came to jeer. Although Roosevelt's self-mockery won the day, his war against the saloons was politically untenable. With the next election cycle approaching, Mayor Strong pressured Roosevelt to let up on the saloon, threatening to fire him if he balked. "He was terribly angry," Roosevelt told Lodge, "but I would not change." The results of the election confirmed the worst fears of Republican leaders. The Democratic Tammany machine roared back into power, regaining all it had lost 2 years earlier. "Reform was beaten," Lincoln Steffens lamented, and the blame was squarely affixed to Roosevelt. The systematic reform he had tried to institute by enforcing the Sunday closing law had been perceived as a curtailment of personal liberty. Roosevelt had failed to frame the narrative as a necessary battle against corruption in such a way as to gain the people's confidence and support. In Albany, the state legislature debated various ways to legislate Roosevelt out of office. A noose was tightening. "Just at present, I am a special object of censure on every side," Roosevelt admitted to Bammy, acknowledging that he now suffered from hours of profound depression. Lodge also worried about his friend and told Bammy he seems overstrained and overwrought, that wonderful spring and interest in all sorts of things is much lowered. Where had Roosevelt's leadership gone astray? "I do not deal with public sentiment, I deal with the law," Roosevelt had repeatedly insisted, but every leader must deal with public sentiment. As Abraham Lincoln had learned from the negative reaction to his intemperate maiden speech before the Congress, when he failed to take into account the widespread popularity of the Mexican-American War. It was one thing for Roosevelt to earn the ire of the political bosses and the saloon keepers, quite another to have become the scapegoat and antagonist of the working class he had worked so hard to understand and befriend. While he had anticipated trouble from the public when he first began to enforce the Sunday law, he had underestimated the intensity of the outcry from working-class immigrants. In contrast to his experience as civil service commissioner, where he had no doubt that his meritocratic efforts were entirely positive, he belatedly realized that there were other times, and the complicated saloon brawl was one, where there was a little of right and wrong on each side. And then it becomes mighty puzzling to know the exact course to follow. So virulent had the personal animosity toward Roosevelt grown that his innovations, policies, and programs risked being diluted or even undone if he stayed longer. He needed to find a way out. He rationalized that his work was accomplished. He had prepared the ground for those who would come after him. And there was truth to his rationalization, for a difficult reform had begun, and it would impact the police department for years to come. William McKinley's 1896 campaign for president provided Roosevelt with the perfect exit. Taking temporary leave from the police board, he stumped far and wide for the Republican nominee and swiftly became one of the most sought-after speakers on the campaign trail. However unpopular he was as police commissioner in New York, his corruption and crime-fighting exploits had made him a compelling figure across the country. Already, Theodore Roosevelt had become a symbol and leader in the war against corruption that in the next decade would win the widespread support of his countrymen. Everywhere he went, he attracted great crowds. The venues jammed, people standing in masses in the aisles. By giving all of his time, all of his energy, and all his towering ability to the work of the campaign, he once again earned the plaudits of the Republican bosses. Returning to the police board after McKinley's victory, Roosevelt waited expectantly for a high post in the new administration. While numerous friends lobbied on his behalf, hopeful for his appointment as Secretary of the Navy, McKinley hesitated. "I want peace," the new president told one Roosevelt ally. "But Theodore, whom I know only slightly, is always getting into rows with everybody. I am afraid he is too pugnacious." Roosevelt's supporters refused to relent, and finally, McKinley made an offer to Roosevelt, the post of Assistant Secretary of the Navy. As so often before, friends cautioned Roosevelt not to settle for this lesser post. But in what had become a familiar pattern, he snatched up the offer. As Assistant Secretary to Navy Secretary John Davis Long, Roosevelt was relegated to an actual subordinate role for the first time, directly answerable to a superior. Potential minefields surrounded the relationship from the start. 2 decades older than Roosevelt, Long, cautious by temperament, personified the status quo of the McKinley administration. Having experienced the horrific years of the Civil War, Long, like McKinley, was committed to preserving the peace. Roosevelt was convinced that a looming war with Spain over their treatment of the Cuban freedom fighters was on the near horizon, and that the Navy must be transformed to address that likelihood. How then did Roosevelt manage this subordinate position? For a start, Roosevelt built up a reserve of good feeling through repeated acts of courtesy, kindness, and helpfulness that secured the trust and confidence of Secretary Long. Recognizing that Long, who had no prior experience with the Navy, was uncomfortable with talk of dry docks, gun turrets, blueprint specifications, or the frailty of torpedo boats, Roosevelt swiftly mastered the technical details involved in overseeing the Navy, the schedules for inspection, repair, and maintenance, the numbers of inactive vessels, the construction of new ships, which he then translated into clear, readable reports delivered to Long's desk every morning. As ever, Roosevelt's voracious scientific and historical reading and writing served him well. In this case, his statistical understanding and expertise, begotten as a fledgling naval historian when he wrote his first published work on the naval battles in the War of 1812, enabled him to easily master telling details that held no interest for his superior, Long. Long was delighted with his industrious young assistant. "He is full of suggestions, many of which are of great value to me," Long remarked, "and his spirited and forceful habit is a good tonic for one who is disposed to be as conservative and careful as I am." Just as Roosevelt had instituted hands-on inspections in the civil service and extended his rambles to the sidewalks of New York, so now he left his desk to investigate, inspect, and review various aspects of the Navy. He was on hand during an investigation of a torpedo accident, spent 5 days reviewing the Naval Reserve Militia in the Midwest, accompanied the 1st Battalion on a practice cruise, and went aboard the Iowa, the Navy's state-of-the-art battleship. When he met with the crew that had designed the ship, he broke the record asking questions, leaving the shipbuilder in a state of amazement at the combination of his theoretical knowledge of construction and his command of the details of bolts and rivets. And just as he had commended policemen on the beat, so he now praised members of the 2nd Battalion after witnessing a field exercise on parade grounds. Even as he surveyed the current readiness of the Navy and appeared to Secretary Long a dutiful and solicitous son, Roosevelt was carefully formulating his agenda to build an expanded, war-ready Navy. Sensitive to the administration's reticence regarding war, he cloaked his plans in the sheep's clothing of preparedness. In a well-publicized speech at the Naval War College, he drew upon the wisdom of the country's first president. "A century has passed since Washington wrote, 'To be prepared for war is the most effectual means to promote peace,'" he began. "In all our history, there has never been a time when preparedness for war was any menace to peace." The speech garnered widespread praise, making Roosevelt a leading proponent of preparedness and war readiness. While pleased with the response, Roosevelt craved action. "I have always had a horror of words that are not translated into deeds," Roosevelt frequently charged. And that summer presented the opportunity for action, when the fatigued Secretary Long retreated to Massachusetts for an 8-week vacation. This was not remarkable in the days before air conditioning. Government officials, including presidents, regularly escaped Washington during the summer. Furthermore, prior to the hot weather setting in, Roosevelt had graciously promised Long that he would give up his family summer at Sagamore Hill to accommodate his superior schedule. Long's protracted hiatus left Roosevelt the acting Secretary of the Navy, and he made the most of his temporary elevation. "The Secretary is away, and I am having immense fun running the Navy," Roosevelt reported to a friend in August. "As I am given a free hand when alone, I am really accomplishing a great deal," he told Bammy. Indeed, under Roosevelt's hot-weather acting secretaryship, ports and coastal fortifications were improved, numerous shakedown cruises were taken, and Congress was lobbied to expand the fleet. Most importantly, Roosevelt's awareness of the disposition of fleets around the world persuaded him that the Pacific sector, where the bulk of the Spanish fleet was stationed, could play an instrumental role if war broke out in Cuba. Consequently, he pulled every string to get the man he wanted appointed commander-in-chief of the Asiatic Squadron, Admiral George Dewey. Though they had met but several times, Roosevelt instinctively recognized in Dewey the right leader for a crisis. "I knew that in the event of war, Dewey could be slipped like a wolfhound from a leash. I was sure that if he were given half a chance, he would strike instantly and with telling effect, and I made up my mind that all I could do to give him that half chance should be done." Simultaneously, he conducted an extended, informative, and affectionate correspondence with Secretary Long, assuring him that all was under control. "You must be tired, and you ought to have an entire rest," he wrote in early August. If things go on as they are now, there isn't the slightest reason for you to come back for 6 weeks more, he reiterated a week later. I am very glad you have been away, he followed up, for it has been the hottest weather we have had. He could not have pressed harder against the bounds of duplicity and not broken them. The relationship Roosevelt had long cultivated with the press aided his quest to build up the Navy. Invited to participate in several cruises, reporters praised the current state of the Navy, but indicated what still needed to be done. On occasion, Roosevelt's comfort with the press led to the publication of overtly bellicose statements that countered the administration's agenda and drew the ire of Secretary Long. In such instances, Roosevelt immediately apologized to Long, accepted his reprimand with grace, restored obedience by promising that his spirit was chastened, and then proceeded exactly as before. He succeeded in keeping Long's trust by remaining beguilingly honest and open about their differences of views. Of paramount importance was simply to acknowledge who was in charge. When a potentially troublesome article appeared in the Boston Herald, charging that Roosevelt was trying to seize for himself the functions and responsibilities of the man in charge, Roosevelt instantly notified Long about the piece and confessed that it greatly discomforted him. He understood, Roosevelt added, that the idea that he would not be a loyal subordinate was just what you were warned against before I came, and he flattered himself to believe that, aside from a few infernal statements, he had done nothing of which Long would have disapproved. While he would continue to present his own views as strongly as possible, when you have once determined on your policy, I shall carry it out in letter and spirit. That both men were truly fond of each other smoothed such occasional tensions. After Long highly praised his subordinate in an interview, Roosevelt wrote to thank him for his generous statements. It has been an entirely new experience for me to serve under a man like you. Of course, you will never have any friction with me, excepting from wholly unintentional slips on my part, for the excellent reason that I should regard myself as entirely unworthy to hold such a position as I do hold if, now that I have a chief like you, I fail to back him up in every possible way. Dramatic reports of Spanish treachery against the Cuban rebels in the winter of 1898, many luridly exaggerated by warmongering newspapers, sparked widespread humanitarian outrage, ratcheting up Roosevelt's sense of urgency about the possible need for intervention. If war should come, it should come finally on our initiative, he beseeched Long. If we drift into it, if we do not prepare in advance and suddenly have to go into hostilities without taking the necessary steps beforehand, we may have to encounter one or two bitter humiliations, and we shall certainly be forced to spend the first 3 or 4 most important weeks not in striking, but in making those preparations to strike which we should have made long before. Roosevelt's warning proved prescient. On February 15th, the USS Maine, stationed in Havana Harbor as an act of friendly courtesy to the Cuban people, exploded, killing 266 Americans. Though the cause of the explosion was never determined, widespread rage and a call to declare war swept the country. Still, President McKinley, who had fought at Antietam the bloodiest battle of the Civil War, hesitated. I have been through one war. I have seen the dead piled up, and I do not want to see another. While the president was plagued with indecision, Roosevelt took a series of unwarranted actions that under any boss other than John Davis Long might well have caused his immediate firing for insubordination. On February 25th, Long left the office for a day's rest. Do not take any step affecting the policy of the administration without consulting the president or me. I am not away from town, and my intention was to have you look after the routine of the office while I get a quiet day off. I write to you because I am anxious to have no unnecessary occasion for a sensation in the papers. Despite this warning, Roosevelt's months of preparatory work burst into coordinated execution. He launched a series of peremptory orders, distributing ships, ordering ammunition, purchasing tons of coal, sending messages to Congress for immediate legislation authorizing the enlistment of an unlimited number of seamen, and finally, ordering Admiral Dewey to keep full of coal and be prepared if war comes to take offensive action to see that the Spanish squadron does not leave the coast. Long discovered these orders when he returned to the office the next morning. Roosevelt, in his precipitate way, has come very near causing more of an explosion than happened to the Maine, he confided to his diary. He means to be thoroughly loyal, but the very devil seemed to possess him yesterday afternoon. Reacting more from compassion than in anger, Long rationalized that Roosevelt had lost his head as a consequence of grave troubles at home. Edith suffered from what doctors would finally diagnose as a massive abscess in a muscle near the base of her spine, requiring a long and dangerous operation to remove. At the same time, Long knew that their 10-year-old son, Theodore Jr., was just recovering from a long and dangerous illness. This combination, Long wanted to believe, accentuated Roosevelt's natural nervousness and prompted him to take action which he otherwise would not for a moment have taken. Long's supposition that Roosevelt's sensitive nature had resulted in a man overburdened by family crises was the opposite of the well-meditated, if transgressive, case at hand on February 25th. Nonetheless, neither Long nor McKinley revoked a single one of Roosevelt's orders. Accordingly, when Congress finally declared war on Spain nearly 9 weeks later, Commander Dewey was well positioned to strike. 2 hours after the Battle of Manila Bay commenced, 7 weeks before the invasion of Cuba, the Spanish Pacific Fleet was decimated, giving the American forces a decided advantage. If it had not been for Roosevelt, we should not have been able to strike the blow we did at Manila, the chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations remarked. It needed just Roosevelt's energy and promptness. American Army officer Leonard Wood later observed that few men would have dared to assume this responsibility, but Theodore Roosevelt knew that there were certain things that ought to be done and that delay would be fatal. He felt the responsibility, and he took it. For Roosevelt, being a subordinate was never confused with being subservient. No sooner had Congress declared war on Spain on April 25, 1898, than Theodore Roosevelt proclaimed that he would resign his Navy post and volunteer for the Army. Not a single friend agreed with what seemed to them an impulsive decision. "I really think he is going mad," one remarked. "The president has asked him twice, as a personal favor, to stay in the Navy Department, but Theodore is wild to fight and hack and hew. It really is sad. Of course, this ends his political career for good." Both his intimate political friend, Cabot Lodge, and his old mentor, William Sewall, emphatically concurred that he had far more important work to do in the Navy Department. Secretary Long worried that he had lost his head in this unutterable folly of deserting his post, where he is of most service, and running off to ride a horse and probably brush mosquitoes from his neck on the Florida sands. "While his heart is right and he means well," he added, "it is one of those cases of aberration, desertion, vainglory, of which he is utterly unaware." Roosevelt's decision was, in fact, anything but rash. His usefulness in the Navy Department, he suspected, would largely disappear in time of war. Not only would the military advisors take center stage, but Secretary Long would steadfastly remain at his post. War would close the doors on his decisive and eventful days as acting secretary. The time had come to find a way out. "My work here has been the work of preparing the tools," he told Sewall. "They are prepared. And now the work must lie with those who use them. I would like to be one of those using the tools." The chance to volunteer in war touched a raw nerve in Theodore. He considered his father's decision to avoid service in the Civil War a stain on his family's honor, even though the decision was made to avert the utter breakdown of his southern wife within a badly strained family dynamic. So now, in the spring of 1898, Despite the fragility of his own family, Edith had not yet recovered from her operation, and young Theodore seemed to be suffering a nervous collapse. Roosevelt felt compelled to serve in Cuba. "You know what my wife and children mean to me," he later told his military advisor, Archie Butt. "And yet, I made up my mind that I would not allow even a death to stand in my way, that it was my one chance to do something for my country and for my family, and my one chance to cut my little notch on the stick that stands as a measuring rod in every family. I know now that I would have turned from my wife's deathbed to have answered that call." Among our four leaders, only Theodore Roosevelt would command men in the heat of a military operation. Only Roosevelt would face an actual enemy with his life and the lives of his men in the balance. When he took command of his troops in Cuba, he was directly responsible for them, an experience that altered and vastly enlarged his confidence in himself as a leader. When the original call for three volunteer regiments to supplement the regular army was issued, it was to be composed exclusively of frontiersmen, possessing special qualifications as horsemen and marksmen. Here was the fortuitous conjunction of precisely the skills Theodore Roosevelt had honed during his years in the Badlands. He had willed himself to become an indefatigable hunter, a reasonable marksman, a cowboy able to stay in the saddle for a dozen hours at a time, inured to extremes of weather, equipped to tolerate all manner of unexpected hardships. Yet, when Secretary of War Russell A. Alger offered Roosevelt the top leadership post, colonel of the first of these three volunteer regiments, he declined. Why, when Roosevelt had the opportunity to actualize a lifelong fantasy of the knight on horseback, the heroic martial figure leading a charge at the forefront of his men, would he decline, and instead defer to his younger friend Leonard Wood? The answer reveals a critical leadership attribute: the self-awareness to soberly analyze his own strengths and compensate for his weaknesses. He declined the offer and recommended Wood solely because he knew that he lacked the experience and technical knowledge to speedily outfit and provision a regiment, the knowledge possessed by Wood, who had served in the regular army and been awarded the Medal of Honor. "I told Alger, after 6 weeks' service in the field, I would feel competent to handle the regiment, but that I did not know how to equip it or how to get it into action." If Wood were made colonel, however, Roosevelt said he would happily, without the slightest reservation or competitiveness, accept the subordinate post of lieutenant colonel. "Alger considered this an act of foolish self-abnegation on my part," Roosevelt later said, "instead of its being what it was, the wisest act I could have performed." Central to Roosevelt's decision was not the title he would enjoy, but the ultimate success of the regiment in which he would share command. Colonel Wood and Lieutenant Colonel Roosevelt formed an effective and complementary team. While Wood requisitioned horses, saddles, tents, blankets, boots, and the like, Roosevelt so successfully promoted the concept and public perception of the regiment, which eventually became known as the Rough Riders, that 20,000 applications were received within 5 days for fewer than 800 places. Projecting a vision of a unique fighting force that would represent a microcosm of the country itself, Roosevelt persuaded the authorities to enlarge the regiment to include a troop of Easterners who, possessed in common with the cowboys, Indians, hunters, and miners, the traits of hardihood and thirst for adventure. He found such qualities among Ivy League football stars, polo players, oarsmen, sportsmen from the Knickerbocker Club and the Somerset Club, and policemen from their beats in New York City. This glamorous mosaic of the country's diversity would form any journalist's dream of a melting pot, and Roosevelt was just the figure to supply sufficient heat to melt these heterogeneous elements into a cohesive unit. In the men he gathered into his regiment, he had quilted together the broad episodes of his life: his willed athleticism, bodybuilding, Harvard education, engagement with hunters and woodsmen in Maine, ranching and riding in the far West, and working with the police force in New York. How was he able to pull these disparate men, regions, and social climes together? Westerners and Easterners, cowboys and the swells, educated and non-educated. To stimulate the fellow feeling he believed essential to the success of the mission, he deliberately arranged the tents at the training ground in San Antonio in such a manner that cowboys and wranglers slept side by side with the scions of financiers. He assigned Knickerbocker Club members to wash dishes for a New Mexico company and brought Easterners and Westerners together in the daily chores of washing laundry and digging and filling in latrines. Eventually, a common denominator emerged throughout the entire regiment, a leveling of money, social status, and education under the aegis of teamwork. Roosevelt understood from the start that leadership had to be earned. It was not something to be granted by rank or title. The frontiersmen who made up the majority of the regiment were individualists, possessed of a disparaging attitude toward entitlement and hierarchy. As he had learned on the cattle drives in the Dakotas, being the one who issued orders and paid wages was not sufficient to becoming a bona fide boss. He had to lead by sharing his life with the men, by his own willingness to do anything he asked them to do, by never asking them to suffer anything he wouldn't suffer first. When we got down to Hardpan, we all, officers and men, fared exactly alike as regards both shelter and food, Roosevelt later wrote. Grumbling ceased when all alike slept out in the open. The crash training course, which provided a formidable learning experience for Roosevelt and his men, was not without mistakes on his part. He had to learn how to be one with his men without overstepping the line of familiarity to the point of diminishing their respect for him. After a successful day of mock drills in the oppressive heat of San Antonio, he announced to his troops, "The men can go in and drink all the beer they want, which I will pay for." Later that evening, Colonel Wood summoned Roosevelt to his tent. He described the various disciplinary confusions and dilemmas that inevitably surfaced when an officer relaxed with his recruits. Wood's admonition was taken to heart. "Sir, I consider myself the damnedest ass within 10 miles of the camp." Chastened, he realized that while he had gained the affection of his troops, he had not established the proper space between himself and his men. "When things got easier, I put up my tent and lived a little apart," Roosevelt recalled, "for it is the greatest possible mistake to seek popularity, either by showing weakness or mollycoddling the men. They never respect a commander who does not enforce discipline." Experience taught him to strike the right balance between affection and respect. In the boiling chaos of the removal from the drill grounds in Texas to Port Tampa, to Cuba, Roosevelt revealed a sure-handed improvisational ability and the administrative initiative to quell confusion, impose order, and skirt protocol to protect his troops. When trains to transport the heavy equipment for his regiment could not be secured, he paid from his own funds. When the canned beef they were fed proved rancid, he demanded and obtained edible provisions. When the boat to convey his men was not available, he occupied another regiment's assigned boat with a combination of stealth and dispatch. Despite filthy, cramped quarters on board, he imposed inspections and roll calls. In a matter of weeks, he had established the kind of leadership that is bonded by two-way trust. He had taken command of his men by assuming responsibility for them. He had shown his men that he was prepared to do anything he could to provide for them. They, in turn, were prepared to give everything he asked of them. The master chord of Theodore Roosevelt's temperament was displayed in the battles and skirmishes of the Rough Riders' engagement in the Spanish-American War. "Forward to the charge! Straight ahead! Charge into the open!" Once the order was set in motion, there was no reverse. "Instead of falling back, they came forward," one Spanish soldier recalled. "This is not the way to fight, to come closer at every volley." Yet, even as dozens of men were killed and wounded along the way, Roosevelt, time and again, propelled his troops toward the enemy. The first battle, at Las Guasimas, began in confusion. As the Rough Riders made their way through the tall grass and twisted brush, they encountered fierce fire from an unseen enemy. Beset by great difficulty, unable to determine what was happening around them, Roosevelt seemed overwrought, jumping up and down with tension, bewilderment, and excitement. What to do next? I had not an idea, he later confessed. When they came upon a cut in a barbed wire fence, indicating the route the Spanish had taken, however, Roosevelt's uneasiness vanished. Leading his men across the wire, heading straight toward the volleys of rifle fire, he suddenly became, according to a witnessing journalist, Edward Marshall, the most magnificent soldier I have ever seen. It was as if that barbed wire strand had formed a dividing line in his life. Leaving indecision behind, Marshall observed, Roosevelt found on the other side of the thicket the coolness, the calm judgment, the towering heroism, which made him perhaps the most admired and best beloved of all Americans in Cuba. Under Roosevelt's lead, the outnumbered Rough Riders charged uphill and drove back the Spanish soldiers. What Roosevelt termed the great day of his life, the day that ended with the triumphant charges up Kettle Hill and San Juan Hill, began with him exhibiting to the Rough Riders the most placid morning-time demeanor, calmly shaving and knotting a blue polka-dot bandana around his neck. Rough Rider Arthur Crosby found it heartening to see our commanding officer on the dawn of a great battle, performing an everyday function, as though we were on an enjoyable camping trip. When orders came to march on Kettle Hill while the regulars attacked San Juan Hill, Roosevelt immediately mounted his horse and mustered his men, shouting, "We must advance! Rough Riders forward! Come on!" With Roosevelt in the colonel's customary position at the rear of the column, the troops advanced hesitantly under a hail of bullets. To inspire his troops to move at an accelerated clip, Roosevelt, the only mounted man, suddenly charged up the lines, rallying his men as he made his way to the front of the regiment. No one who saw Roosevelt take that ride expected he would finish it alive, Davis reported. Seated high on his horse with his blue polka-dot bandana floating out straight behind his head, he was the most conspicuous object in the range of the rifle pits. Ascending the hill, Roosevelt's troops were blocked by another regiment that had not yet received the official order to attack. "If you don't wish to go forward, let my men pass, please," Roosevelt addressed the captain. "Up, up they went, in the face of death," one reporter marveled. "Men dropping from the ranks at every step. The Rough Riders acted like veterans. It was an inspiring sight, and an awful one." Roosevelt remained erect on his horse all the way, shouting for his men to follow, until at last they forced the Spanish to retreat and reach the summit, cheering and filling the air with cowboy yells. Within short order, the city of Santiago was captured, and the Spanish surrendered. In newspapers, magazines, and journals across the country, Roosevelt was melodramatically portrayed as the man who had single-handedly crushed the foe. Although Roosevelt effusively credited his regiment in multiple military reports and numerous conversations with journalists, carefully citing individuals he felt warranted special recognition, it was the iconic image of the man on horseback, the face so amenable to caricature, that became the emblem of American valor. "You are the next governor of New York," reporters shouted at Roosevelt when his regiment arrived at Montauk Point, Long Island. The situation was not so simple, however, as Roosevelt well understood. While he might be the choice of the people at large, the political machine controlled the nomination, and the powerful old boss Thomas Platt had no desire to see a reformer like Theodore in the governor's chair. In this instance, fate smiled upon Roosevelt. Once again, the Republican Party's prestige had been besmeared by an exposé of corruption in the current Republican administration in Albany. Believing the hero of San Juan the only candidate who could rescue the party from defeat, Platt reluctantly agreed to support him for the nomination. On September 15, 1898, the Rough Riders disbanded. 2 days later, Theodore Roosevelt entered the governor's race. The war veteran who ran for the highest office in New York State was not the same man who had volunteered to fight in Cuba. A more deep-seated, durable confidence in his leadership capacities had been earned. "In my regiment," he told his son, "9/10 of the men were better horsemen than I was, and 2/3 better shots than I was. While on the average, they were certainly hardier and more enduring. Yet after I had them a very short while, they knew, and I knew too, that nobody else could command them as I could." After the experience of leading his men in combat, earning not only their trust but their devotion, Roosevelt had come to believe that leadership itself constituted the chief of his talents. Perhaps due in some measure to the heroic image disseminated by the press, the returning colonel projected a newly minted charisma that enabled him to emotionally connect to his audiences. Though candidates in those days rarely campaigned on their own behalf, relying instead on the political machine to whip up voters, Roosevelt stumped the state up and down and across and zigzag, speaking by day from the end of his special train and at night at mass meetings in the towns and cities. He had an aura, one observer noted, electrical, magnetic. Audiences discovered that indefinable something which led men to follow him up the bullet-swept hill of San Juan. Less than 3 months after returning home, Theodore Roosevelt was elected governor of New York. Casting an eye over the improbable Cuban summer, the campaign, and the election, he wrote to a friend, Cecil Spring Rice, "I have played it in bull luck this summer. First, to get into the war, then to get out of it, then to get elected. I have worked hard all my life and have never been particularly lucky, but this summer I was lucky, and I am enjoying it to the full. I know perfectly well that the luck will not continue, and it is not necessary that it should. I am more contented to be governor of New York," he added, invoking a refrain psychologically necessary to him throughout his career, and always ending with, "I shall not care if I never hold another office." Roosevelt's newfound composure, patience, and maturity were immediately apparent in his adroit handling of the traditional undertow and riptides of New York politics. To reestablish his reputation as a reformer, he had to prove his independence. To get anything accomplished, he had to work with Boss Platt and his political machine. Within days of taking office, he announced that he would make weekly pilgrimages from Albany to New York City to meet with Boss Platt for breakfast or lunch. To reformers who complained that he was belittling the dignity of the office by running down to confer with the conservative, business-oriented Platt, Roosevelt countered that he had no sympathy for those who found it essential to preserve their dignity by asserting their right to enter a room first or to sit on a red instead of a green chair. When he was younger, Roosevelt acknowledged, he was too prone to quarrel over trivial matters. The more he read about Abraham Lincoln, the more he valued Lincoln's willingness to yield lesser issues for more important ones. No man resolved to make the most of himself can spare time for personal contention, Lincoln was wont to say. A conciliatory tone with Platt cost the new governor nothing and could well enhance future endeavors. Moreover, Roosevelt was sensitive to the old man's pride. Despite the appearance of capitulating to the boss, he was happy to meet on Platt's home ground. In Albany, Roosevelt scheduled every moment of his day with quick, military precision, allotting the scores of daily petitioners specific time slots of 5 or 10 minutes. No sooner had the visitor entered the room than the governor jumped up from behind his desk to greet him. "I am delighted to see you," he began, warmly clasping the visitor's hand. During these sessions, Roosevelt remained ever on his feet, pacing restlessly back and forth, encouraging immediate discussion of the meat of the subject. Listening intently, he rapidly absorbed whether he would accede to the request take it under advisement or regret that he had to say no. Once the decision was rendered, the visitor was gently ushered out of the office with hardly a slack moment before the next visitor entered. During his tenure as governor, Roosevelt liked to reference an old African proverb, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." If a leader continually blusters, lacks civility, or likes to quarrel, Roosevelt cautioned, he would not go far. Nor would he succeed by speaking softly if strength and power did not lay back of that softness. As always, a good leader must make it clear that if negotiation fails, as a last resort, he would be willing to turn his back and walk away. Two struggles during his governorship, the fight over a franchise tax, and the reappointment of an insurance commissioner with suspected illicit ties to the insurance industry, best illustrate how Roosevelt successfully navigated his contentious relationship with the political machine. Roosevelt discovered that for decades past, the New York legislature had granted exclusive franchises worth tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars to corporations to operate electric street railways, telephone networks, and telegraph lines. Such lucrative franchises were regularly awarded with no attempt to secure tax revenues in return. Recompense came in the form of campaign contributions to fuel the Platt machine, funds which were then distributed to candidates for the state legislature with the gentleman's understanding they could be counted upon for important votes, particularly those related to corporate interests. It was a matter of plain decency that corporations receiving great benefits from the public should pay their fair share of the public burden, the new governor flatly concluded, after thoroughly researching the franchise issue. He sent a special message to the legislature indicating his support for a franchise tax bill. The bill's surprise passage, just before the legislature adjourned, set off a storm of protest from the business world. Overnight, the stock market plunged. Angry corporate representatives descended upon Roosevelt, threatening to move their operations to a more accommodating state. Platt, in a bitter letter, promised an ugly confrontation unless Roosevelt summoned the courage to correct the big mistake of his life by declining to sign the bill. Refusing to be bullied, yet understanding that a break with the machine would be politically fatal, Roosevelt agreed to hold a hearing with corporate representatives in order to solicit suggestions for improvements in the bill. So long as the kernel of the bill remained intact, he considered everything else the husk, which he was willing, if necessary, to discard. Persuaded by these conferences that sections of the law were carelessly drawn, he consented to call the legislature back into a special session to modify the bill. If the ultimate product weakened the principle of taxation in any essential way, however, he was fully prepared to restore and sign the original bill. The final legislation both protected the core principle of taxation and made minimal concessions, allowing Platt to save face with his constituents in the business community. Roosevelt's inclination to speak softly and carry a big stick brought an even more troubling dispute with the Republican organization to a desirable outcome. He had heard rumors that Platt's right-hand man, Superintendent of Insurance Lou Payne, had intimate dealings with companies he was assigned to regulate. Roosevelt decided to conduct his own inquiry. Preliminary evidence was sufficient to persuade him that Payne should not be reappointed once his 3-year term ended. Platt met Roosevelt's decision with an ultimatum. By law, the incumbent could remain in office until a successor was confirmed. Since the machine controlled the Senate, Platt effectively had the power to veto any replacement the governor chose. The boss made it clear to Roosevelt that he intended to use that power as long as necessary. "I persistently refused to lose my temper, no matter what he said," Roosevelt recalled. "I had made up my mind," he simply explained to Platt, "that the gentleman in question would not be retained." To ease the matter, he gave Platt a list of 4 good machine men and told the boss to select any one of the 4. Platt refused to budge. Reformers abused Roosevelt for negotiating at all with Platt. They wanted him to wage open warfare. The impasse dragged on for weeks until further investigation disclosed a $400,000 loan Payne had received from a trust company controlled by an insurance firm under his own jurisdiction. To prevent a scandal, Platt quietly capitulated, agreeing to the nomination of one of the men on Roosevelt's list. If he had yelled and blustered in public, Roosevelt told a friend, he would not have mustered 10 votes in the Senate. By the same token, if he had not wielded the big stick, the organization would not have gotten behind him. He had preserved his relationship with Platt by the simple process of telling him the truth, of always letting him know before anyone else when he was going to do something that I knew would be disagreeable to him. Platt respected Roosevelt's personal candor. I have ever preferred that a man should tell me face to face that he will or will not do a thing than to promise to do it and then to not do it. Despite the governor's ostensible truce with Platt, the business corporation served notice on Platt's political organization that if Roosevelt were renominated, they would refuse to contribute to the Republican Party's campaign chest. Since it was risky to flagrantly deny the popular governor a second term, the organization devised a perfect solution. They would promote Roosevelt to the most dignified and harmless position in the gift of his country, the vice presidency. Exiling him to the vice presidency would kill two birds with one stone. The chronic irritant of his presence would be excised from New York politics. At the same time, the Republican Party in McKinley would be invigorated by Roosevelt's charisma and energy on the national campaign trail. Boss Platt's scheme attracted the support of all the party bosses in the Republican Party, save one. Mark Hanna, Republican Party chair. "Don't you know that there's only one life between that madman and the White House?" he warned. Even Hanna eventually concluded, however, that Roosevelt would add more traction to the national ticket than any other candidate. At first, Roosevelt strongly resisted the so-called promotion. He had no desire to be the figurehead in a job then considered a graveyard for political ambitions. Not a single vice president had been elected to the presidency in over 60 years. He understood, however, that if he refused the nomination, people would say, "Roosevelt has a big head and thinks he's too much of a man to be vice president." When the convention nominated him by acclamation, he felt he had no choice but to accept with gratitude and grace. "His enemies triumphed," Jacob Riis wrote. At last, they had him where they wanted him. For the first time in a decade and a half of focusing his full concentration on the job at hand, Roosevelt occupied a job where his active temperament could gain no hold. Frustration, depression born of inactivity, grew by the day in that useless and empty position where he was bereft of the spotlight he craved as a plant craves sunshine. The president gave him no responsibilities, nor did he seek Roosevelt's advice. Roosevelt grew so bored that he contemplated returning to law school. Wistfully, he told his close friend William Howard Taft, then fully engaged as Governor General in the Philippines, "I am not doing any work, and do not feel as though I was justifying my existence. More and more it seems to me that about the best thing in life is to have a piece of work worth doing, and then to do it well." Friends counseled patience. They remained fully confident that the White House would be his future home. But Roosevelt reasoned that by the time McKinley's second term ended, his window upon the presidency might be shut forever. Life had shown him that logic and step-by-step planning hardly controlled events. Before an opportunity might arise to attain the presidency, the position he could scarcely bring himself to mention aloud, he knew the kaleidoscope would have shifted completely, and the odds are that an entirely new set of men and set of issues will be at the front. Moreover, to change the metaphor, the chances are strong that the pendulum will have swung back and that a Democratic victory will be in order. Kaleidoscopes and pendulums, Roosevelt's images connoted an abiding belief in the hard lesson of his crucible philosophy. All one can do is prepare oneself to wait in readiness for what might come. Chance had placed him in the catapult, and now it was up to the vagaries of history to cut the catapult's rope. On September 6, 1901, an assassin's bullet brought McKinley's life to a slow end, and at 42 years of age, Theodore Roosevelt was shot into the presidency, the youngest man to occupy the White House in the history of the country.
Chapter 7 Franklin Roosevelt. Above all, try something. On a late August day in 1921 at Campobello, the family's island retreat off Downeast Maine, Franklin Roosevelt awoke with a mild sensation that something was wrong. His back ached, and he felt oddly enervated. Nothing serious, he assumed. Physical activity would surely shake off this peculiar torpor. From youth, Roosevelt took keen pleasure in a large range of physical exertion. His earliest letters expressed the thrill of sledding, skating, and fishing with his father. He developed into an avid golfer, tennis player, sailor, and horseback rider. While neither strong nor muscular, he was agile and graceful. A family friend never forgot the vision of young Franklin leaping, like some amazing stag, across a brook. An observer at the 1920 convention was struck by the moment he hurdled four or five chairs in order to make a motion. It was the most wonderful athletic feat, she recalled. So rather than surrendering to his weariness by remaining in bed, he had launched upon a day of strenuous physical activity. First, he embarked on a long sail with Eleanor and their two oldest sons. On their return home, they spotted a brush fire on one of the islands. Bringing the boat close to shore, they jumped out and spent an hour slapping down smoldering flames. Eyes bleary with smoke, they no sooner had reached their cottage when Franklin challenged the boys to jog a mile and a half to their favorite swimming spot, a freshwater pond on the other side of the island. Still unrefreshed and uncomfortable after swimming, he raced the boys back home and plunged into the ice-cold Bay of Fundy. Then, suddenly so lethargic he was unable to take off his wet bathing suit, he slumped on the porch and tried to sort through mail. Abruptly, he announced that he had a severe chill and would go straight to bed. I'd never